This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The 61st Cannes Film Festival, the world's most important showcase for new movies from around the world, wrapped up on Sunday. This year's festival along the French Riviera was broad enough to include the world premieres of the new Indiana Jones film, Clint Eastwood's new film, art films from around the world that will eventually open in the U.S., and films that will never find an American distributor. Our critic at large, John Powers, has been to Cannes many times. He's joining us from London to talk about this year's festival, and there's plenty to talk about. Let's start with an overview of the festival. What made this year's Cannes Festival different from others?
This year what was striking was two things. One is that the films were, by and large, pretty good. I think last year was considered to be the greatest year in 20 years, and perhaps the films weren't as good as that. But I think almost every day I saw something really interesting and good, and even the ones I didn't like, I thought were interesting to think about and argue about. That's at the level of the films. At the level of the vibe of the festival, I think for Americans there, this may be the year when, because of declining subscriptions to newspapers and declining advertising, that Cannes started to seem slightly, you know, seemed to be like a place that you might not be going back to in the future. There was a sense that the euro is so powerful against the dollar, because suddenly, if you're an American abroad, the dollar isn't worth very much. Also, there weren't as many American film distributors there to pick up the movies. So the American presence was slightly smaller this year and slightly gloomy, because everyone was thinking, art movies don't sell in the U.S., foreign movies don't sell in the U.S., nobody wants to go see them, and at the same time, lots of film critics at various publications are getting fired. So that kind of atmosphere colored a lot of Cannes, but I don't think the rest of the people there felt that, but certainly the Americans did feel it.
So do you think the fact that there are fewer newspapers and fewer film critics now because the film critics are getting laid off, is that one of the reasons why film distributors are reluctant to pick up art films and foreign films?
Well, I think that it's probably a vicious circle, that the fewer critics you have praising art films means that fewer people hear about them. But also, editors think that fewer people are going to art films, and so why should you have someone who spends a lot of time writing about them? So you have an overall mental state, I think, among American film people that things are kind of not in the best shape they could be, at least in terms of the films that would play at Cannes. At the same time, of course, the big single event at Cannes was the launch of the new Indiana Jones movie.
Let me just stop you. I don't understand it. Why is it that Indiana Jones, which is this big commercial blockbuster sequel to the sequel of the sequel, what's it doing at Cannes? Why do you need like a film festival at Cannes to show Indiana Jones?
Well, I guess what happens is you get all these film people there and they want to be there to be first and to feel special. And then because every journalist, anyway, has an editor back home, wherever his or her country is, that is obsessed with Indiana Jones because it's the big movie of the era, they're all told they have to go. So you had this strange spectacle. On the Sunday that it played, I was out to lunch for Woody Allen and Penelope Cruz, who made a very enjoyable film about sort of a romantic romp in Barcelona. And about 40 minutes into the lunch, all the other journalists stood up and basically apologized to Penelope Cruz and said, "I've got to go." And she said, "I know where you're going." And she was right. They were going to wait for 2 hours outside the Palais, where they show all the big films, to see the Indiana Jones movie, because that became the big event. And I think the festival kind of encourages those kinds of big events. It showed the Da Vinci Code 2 or 3 years ago, partly because the entire world is then looking at you.
Well, before we talk about the winning films at the Cannes Film Festival, let's just talk a little bit about the jury that selected the films. It was headed this year by Sean Penn. What kind of jury head was he? How did he instruct the jury?
Yes, well, on the first day, Sean Penn basically told the press that his mission as the jury head was to make sure that they made films connect with the real world in social and political themes. And he said it so overtly, you know, filled with sort of an obligatory attack on George Bush along the way, that one of his other jurors, Marjan Satrapi, who made the film Persepolis, said, "Well, we're going to care about aesthetics too. You know, we don't want to choose things that'll be embarrassing in 10 years. And so all along, we all kept thinking, as the films would show, you know, would Sean like this? Because film critics always talk as though we know Sean Penn. Would Sean like this? And what will Marjan say? And then in the event of the actual awards, it more or less followed the social line that Sean Penn would like, which is almost all the things that won have a big social theme. Yet the jury voted unanimously for its winner and seemed to be quite a happy jury. partly because a lot of the social-themed and political-themed films were well-made or interestingly made.
Well, let's look at the film that won the top prize, the Palme d'Or, and this was a unanimous verdict from the movie from the jury. Tell us what the movie was.
Okay. The first thing that should be said is that where you appear at Cannes can sometimes make a difference at how you do. This was the last film shown in competition. It was shown after a lot of journalists had left. But it's traditionally a good slot because in the psychology of watching film after film, if you have a good one at the end, it often tends to override all the others. And the film The Class by Laurent Canté is a good film. It's based on a semi-autobiographical novel by a guy by the name of François Begadeau, who spent a year teaching in a multicultural Paris high school where he had Chinese students, Moroccan students, Malian students. And he was their French teacher. And he had a combative year. Anyway, the entire movie takes place within the walls of the school. And we basically watch the guy teach his class, fight with the students sass him get to know the students, you know, discover their problems. The Chinese kid who's the best student in the class, his mother is going to be deported because she's an illegal alien. The Malian student is a troublemaker. But when you try to tell his parents about it, they can't speak any French. So you have to tell him your criticisms of him and he passes them on to them. And so what you get is an entire view, I think, of how France sees its new multicultural society, with this one teacher who's charismatic and arrogant and not always right and makes lots of mistakes but is very smart and well-meaning trying to deal with this class. And, you know, it's enormously entertaining film, incredibly well-made. The guy who wrote the novel who was the teacher plays himself in the film. He's not an actor and is terrific. And the students in the class were students from that school. And, you know, basically they weren't actors either. But the movie's so incredibly intensely alive that I think almost everyone who saw it, you know, was really happy to have seen it.
Well, let's look at the runner-up at Cannes. And I think this verdict was also unanimous from the jury.
It was. It's a really terrific film called Gomorrah. It's an Italian film that's about the influence of the underworld group known as the Camorra in and around the city of Naples. It's actually bigger and more powerful than the mafia. And what the story does is it intersects five different stories of people in the community and how their lives are affected by organized crime. You know, one of them is a guy who's basically doing illegal toxic waste dumping and basically takes contracts and promises to get rid of the toxic waste and then just puts it in places that it enters people's waters. One of it's in the fashion industry where people are trying to undercut each other because the organized crime actually controls the sewing of high fashion articles in that area, and that does most of the high fashion stuff in the world. So there's a story about that. There's a story about two young guys who watch Scarface and want to be Scarface. And over the course of the film, you get this sense of how in this area of Italy, there's no escaping the influence of this, and everyone is more or less trapped. And if you try to do anything to escape, you can't escape because no matter what you do, you're implicated in the power of organized crime. I mean, it's a really terrific film. It, you know, makes a lot of American gangster films look rather foolish and sentimental, I think.
Now, the most controversial and talked about movie, as far as I can tell, at the Cannes Film Festival didn't make it to the top three awards, and that's the film Che, which was directed by Steven Soderbergh. And, you know, I've been hearing about it on talk radio and reading about it in the newspapers. Why is this film so controversial?
What makes it controversial is that it starts off being 4.5 hours, broken into two parts. Actually, at the screening, they had an intermission where they fed the critics, you know, crummy sandwiches, just because it's so long. But what makes it controversial is that if you imagined all the things you might put in a Che Guevara film, for example, the entry into Havana, or the moment when they take that famous photograph of Che, or the moment when he orders some executions after the revolution if you don't like Che, or the moment he's killed the famous photograph of him out on the table, or almost anything you'd expect to see in a Che Guevara film isn't there. The film is two parts. The first part shows him basically in the jungles fighting to win in Cuba, and the moment they win, the movie ends and you don't see the arrival in Havana. And then the second part is his failed campaign to win in Bolivia. And it's all very process-oriented and on the ground, very undramatic, almost pointedly undramatic. And the two are mirror image stories. One, it's the success of revolution. One is the failure of a revolution. And I guess the movie is about that, the two sides of revolution. When I try to appreciate it on its own terms, I think it's pretty good. But when I think that this is a story about one of the most influential and important people of the 20th century, I'm then struck that this is basically a mass hero's story turned into an elite art film. An elite art film for $65 million, which I guess is my objection to it. And I was struck when I talked to people from outside the U.S., in particular Latin America, you know, they were all thinking, well, no one's going to go see this. You know, this version of Che, which I think is almost unreleasable in its current form in any country in the world.
Well, in fact, no distributors picked it up yet.
Yes, no distributors have picked it up. They're going to want to cut it way down. And, it, you know, I'm not sure it'll get much better if you cut it way down, because it has an artistic integrity of its own, but it's a very perverse artistic integrity. I mean, Steven Soderbergh is a very odd filmmaker. You know, he's, you know, one of his last films was, you know, the Good German, which is trying to copy Hollywood stuff. He's made a film that's like a Fassbinder film. He made a remake of a Russian movie by Andrei Tarkovsky. Here, this is sort of in the tradition of Francesco Rosi and Roberto Rossellini. It's a very cold, objective, outside look at this guy. The problem is that, you know, in Latin America, Che Guevara is considered something of a god, and no one wants to go see a version of it that doesn't take you inside it, doesn't show you what he's like, doesn't talk about his romantic life, doesn't talk about his fights with Fidel, doesn't talk about any of that. I mean, almost everything you would think would be in a $65 million, 4.5-hour movie about Che Guevara isn't in the movie.
Let me ask you, you know, if they divide it into two separate films, which seems to be the plan, would it still have an impact if you're not seeing those mirror images back to back?
Well, it's a completely different film if you see them back to back. But in addition to that, as a friend said, you can't show them separately because no one at the end of the first film would ever pay to see the second film. You know, you basically are stuck with the fact that it's much better if you see both parts. And you know, when we saw it at Cannes, at the end of the first half, people are kind of like, what in the world are we seeing? And by the end, you knew what you were seeing, whether you liked it or not. You knew that it actually was a complete thing. You know, it's not like something like Kill Bill, where you could actually break it in half, and the first half ends with an amazing tea house slaughter with action, 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 and then the second film is different. They're very much of a piece, although they're shot in ways that I'm sure will drive people crazy, because the first in the glory of revolution is shot in widescreen, and then the second part, where the revolution is failing in Bolivia, the screen isn't even as wide. So it's going to be a tricky commercial thing. I mean, I thought of it as, you know, the moment I saw it, I thought, this is a real folly, you know, with a lot of the upside of folly, but a lot of the downside, too.
We should mention that Benicio del Toro won the Best Actor Award for his performance as Che.
Yes, no, Benicio del Toro, who's a wonderful actor, won. I don't think it's anywhere near his best performance, because the movie's so stripped down and minimalist in its way that he's given almost nothing to do. He does it very well, but you can imagine that, because he's wanted to make this film for years, him thinking, oh no, you know, here I am, and like most of my acting is like giving a wry smile. You know, there's very little of the dramatic, romantic Che that I think most people would expect to see, even if only to dislike it. But, you know, because, you know, Che Guevara did a lot of terrible, terrible things.
There were a couple of special awards given at the Cannes Film Festival, and one of them went to Clint Eastwood for his new movie, The Changeling, which stars Angelina Jolie. So what do you think of the film? What do you think of her performance?
I think it's probably Clint Eastwood's least good film in several years. You know, even though part of it was shot a few blocks from my house, you know, I would see the thing and it became kind of like my version of Rocky, you know, where I knew the neighborhood and therefore was excited. It's a rather dull story about a child who disappears, and then the cops bring him back, and the mother, played by Angelina Jolie, is convinced it's not the same child. And from that, it expands out into something that should be hugely interesting about corrupt cops and the sexist use of psychiatry and all of that. But somehow it's just rather flat and off, you know, in the way that filmmakers sometimes should make a film that's off. And Angelina Jolie is, I think, not designed to play a working-class mom. Partly because she looks so thin in this film. She's eerily thin, especially for a period film, because the film is set in the 1920s. And this is maybe the first film where I think somehow Eastwood hasn't been able to negotiate his way around the huge stardom of the person at the center of the film. And so I think I find it very disappointing. You know, some people really, really loved it. I think he got the special award because the French feel, not altogether correctly, that they invented Clint Eastwood as a star. And they would want to honor him with something, even though I think they didn't particularly like the film. I mean, at the beginning, people thought Sean Penn would give him the Palme d'Or because he'd worked with Clint Eastwood and won his Oscar with him. But I think you just couldn't give that film the top prize when there were so many films better than that.
The French feel like they discovered him as an actor because of the Sergio Leone movies?
Well, I think, you know, I think they think they discovered him as an artist. I think they think that, you know, foolish Americans only liked Clint Eastwood as a shoot-'em-up guy, whereas early on they liked him as a person doing complicated things as an actor in things like Dirty Harry, and then later as a director. They feel they got in on the ground floor of Clint Eastwood, the director.
I see.
And they think that, you know, that... They're not completely right. I mean, I can name American critics who championed Clint Eastwood's directing from the beginning. But in general, I think his international prestige did start in France, where they said, this guy's actually doing interesting stuff. You probably all think he's a dumb right-wing gun-toter. But in fact, he's in the great tradition of a lot of those Western directors, because that's what he was doing back then. Like, you know, like John Ford. He's a complicated guy. And that they then sort of taught American critics how to look at Clint Eastwood and see what's interesting about him.
Catherine Deneuve won a special award at the Cannes Film Festival for her performance. What was the film she was in?
She was in a film called A Christmas Tale by Arnaud Desplechin. It's one of my very favorite films of the festival, and it will be released in the U.S. And it's sort of about the coming together at Christmas time of a family that we might say is kind of like Salinger's glass family. Hugely dysfunctional, hugely brilliant, everybody's special. And Deneuve plays the mom who likes some of the kids and doesn't like some of her kids and doesn't seem to care that she doesn't like some of the kids. You know, she's really, really good. This movie is kind of classic old-style French filmmaking with lots of good characters. So interesting. I mean, it's sort of a little bit of Fanny and Alexander, but with a little French twist. You know, it's a really good film. I was surprised it didn't win more at the festival, in fact.
So what were your favorite films at Cannes?
Yes. My favorite film that didn't get anything was a little film called The Woman Without a Head by Lucretia Martel, an Argentine filmmaker who's a really good filmmaker. It's the simplest story in a way. A woman is driving along. She's a dentist. She's driving along a country road. She thinks she's run over something. She looks back, and we see that she has run over something, but she drives off. She's bumped her head when she braked after hitting the thing. And for the next 80 minutes, you sort of follow her through her ordinary life as she gradually realizes that she's probably run over somebody who's poor. And this is how she deals with it. But the whole film basically is just her wandering through her life with a slight concussion. And the way the film is shot shows you who she thinks is important, who registers on her consciousness, who doesn't register on her consciousness. And gradually you realize the whole film is about the way the upper middle class people in Argentina more or less take advantage of the poor people around them and yet keep putting it out of their mind, yet at the very back of their mind, like the woman who keeps thinking she might have run over something, is this sense that, are we doing something wrong here? Are we doing something wrong here? Because it keeps nagging away. And it's a very brilliant sort of Buñuelian kind of metaphor for the way that lots of us in the world won't notice that there are people around us doing nasty jobs and serving us all the time.
And there's another movie I know you liked a lot that's an Israeli film called Waltzing with Bashir. What's that about?
Yes. Oh, it's a very daring film. It's an Israeli filmmaker named Ari Folman. Had served with the Israeli occupation troops in Lebanon in the 80s. And he has this haunting sense that he's forgotten what actually happened the night of the massacre at the two Palestinian refugee camps of Sabra and Shatila. And he basically then tells an animated documentary about himself going to talk to his friends who served with him, flying off as they try to reconstruct what they were doing at that time. So they all tell their stories in a sort of rotoscoped animation, kind of like Richard Linklater has done in a couple of his films, where you see this historical event told autobiographically and in documentary style, but in animation. And it's all about his coming to terms with his responsibility for what was the murder of a couple thousand people. You know, what was striking about it was that I think this is the kind of film that would be very hard to make in the U.S.
Why?
I think because Israelis, compared to Americans, feel freer in talking about the darker sides of Israeli history, whereas I think it's one of the peculiar political problems in the U.S. that when you try to bring these things up, you know, suddenly names start being called and people being accused of stuff, whereas in Israel, this stuff occurs all the time. So it's not surprising to anybody who sees foreign films that often the harshest and most critical and most intelligent looks at the downside of things that have happened in Israel come from Israelis, you know, and you know, they're far keener than you know. There are lots of people in Europe who don't like Israel, but their commentary, I think, on Israeli problems is never as sharp, as acute, or as hard hitting as the Israeli commentary.
So you think that if Wasn't with Bashir was made in the United States, it might be accused of being anti-Israel?
I think it would be accused of being anti-Israel, and it's quite a sensational movie just because it's haunting and it's beautiful and it's a truly horrible story. You know, I was thinking, you know, that that one of the things I like about it is it shows a willingness to feel guilty about doing something bad. Lots of countries do terrible things and never acknowledge it, whereas, you know, Israeli culture is filled with people constantly talking about this.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our critic at large, John Powers, is joining us from a BBC studio in London. We're talking about the Cannes Film Festival, which wrapped up Sunday on the French Riviera. It's the world's most important showcase and marketplace for films from around the world. John, some of the American films by brand name people didn't get picked up for distribution. We've talked about Che by Steven Soderbergh and how that hasn't found a distributor yet. Charlie Kaufman, who wrote the screenplays for Being John Malkovich, Adaptation, and Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, he made his directorial debut with a film that premiered at Cannes. That didn't get picked up for distribution. So what's going on?
Well, I think that people worry more and more about picking up things that may not appeal to a mass audience. I think the film business is changing and people are more and more scared. You know, in the case of the Charlie Kaufman movie, I think what happened was that everyone expected it to be fun and light, and all the marketing people saw it and thought, I'm not sure how I can sell this. I think it's a terrific movie. Philip Seymour Hoffman plays a playwright who's married to Catherine Keener, and then gradually he starts losing it. He gets involved with another woman, and as a playwright, he decides he's going to comment on his own life and try to figure it out, gradually building almost an entire version of New York City that is peopled by not only himself and his girlfriend, but an actor playing himself and his girlfriend. And it's a huge proliferation. Basically, you're caught inside this guy's psyche, which is obsessed with death and regret and longing. In some ways, I think it's the best Charlie Kaufman script. If you've seen the other films, you'll know what that might mean. It's about solipsism and trying to get out of solipsism. It's about the horror of the self and yet the self's infinite ability to imagine itself in different kinds of situations. I mean, I thought it was a really interesting movie. I was startled that a lot of people didn't seem to like it. I think it will get picked up. I think that it's now just a question of negotiating the price.
You know, Americans tend to think of Hollywood as being the movie center of the world, and it certainly has been the movie center of the world. But when you're at Cannes, does it still seem like the movie center of the world?
One of the things I love about going to Cannes is that I'll be sitting in a theater, and around me people will be talking about, say, the Turkish director, Nuri Ceylan, as if he's the most important director in the world. You know, they come from that part of the world. He's the most famous director making films and probably their best director making films. And the entire conversation will be about him. And then you move over to someplace else and you will have people arguing over which was the best Argentine film in the competition. And it's a useful reminder, I think, for all of us, because American culture is so powerful, to realize that while it's powerful in most countries people care about their own things more than ours. You know, that no country really gets to be center of the world, no matter how much it wants to be. It can be the most powerful country. And I think there's actually something kind of beautiful and moving every time I go in realizing that for people from Morocco or Israel or Thailand, their director is the really interesting story. And it's kind of nice that Steven Spielberg's there and that Woody Allen's made another movie. But they care about how their film was received, what it says about their country, what it says about their film industry, about their world, and they care about the countries around them. And I think there's something, you know, that's one of the reasons why Cannes is such a great festival, is every year I have that experience.
So who are the big celebrities at Cannes this year?
Well, I think Cannes is always filled with celebrities. I mean, Angelina Jolie, probably among the women, was the great celebrity. She was there with Kung Fu Panda. You know, they had little people in panda suits on the streets of Cannes. promoting Kung Fu Panda, and she was there in the Clint Eastwood film. Harrison Ford was there. Steven Spielberg was there. And, of course, I certainly shouldn't mention Angelina Jolie without mentioning Brad Pitt. You know, Michael Moore was there. He has become, you know, he's the Paris Hilton now of Cannes. I mean, you simply can't avoid him there.
He wears more clothes than she does.
He does. He wears more clothes. Or is, you know, that all sorts of international stars are there. And that's part of the excitement of it. Although what's so charming about the festival is whenever you step out of the Palais, there are always people, dozens, maybe hundreds of people, who are just ordinary citizens holding up signs as if they're greeting you at an airport. And it will say, you know, do you have a ticket for whatever the film is that day. And it doesn't matter whether it's Indiana Jones or whether it's the small film from the Philippines. People are always standing outside wanting those tickets because there's something about walking into that big Palais, walking up the red carpet with the best projection you'll ever see in the world that's so exciting people want to be part of it. And because it's France, the people are so open to all kinds of movies.
Well, John, the Cannes Film Festival wrapped up over the Memorial Day weekend. There was also some sad film news over the holiday weekend, and that was that the director and actor Sidney Pollack died of cancer. We're going to be hearing an interview from our archive with him coming up, but I'd be interested in hearing what you have to say about Pollack and his work.
Yes. Well, I think Sidney Pollack was a director who came along at a time when probably what he did was underrated. You know, that I think he first became famous to a lot of people around the period of The Way We Were and 3 Days of a Condor, and he more or less seemed to be competing with the great Coppola, Scorsese, Altman genius period. In fact, he was a traditional Hollywood filmmaker and a very good one, of the kind that I think now almost anyone who knows anything about film really regrets we don't have. You know, that his films were always well-made, well-acted, intelligent, solid. He actually was, you know, he was a mark of quality, but of an old-school kind of quality rather than a daring avant-garde or experimental quality. And you know, I liked a lot of his films, you know, when I was younger. Yeah, I think in later years they've been a little less good, not so much because of him necessarily, but because the whole film culture has changed. You know, Sidney Pollack made movies for grown-ups, and he'd never fared quite so well once people started making movies about superheroes. Curiously, you know, just as Clint Eastwood stopped being so much of a movie star and became famous as a director, Pollack became an actor in later years. You know, I mean, he'd acted all along, but in fact, he was this very sharp presence in something like Michael Clayton, or the Stanley Kubrick erotics film. You know, he would show up, and he had a very grown up in the best sense, strong edge to him that made him good. He could be warm if he needed to be. He could be cold if he needed to be. So he was a really terrific screen actor who I was always happy to see.
And in Tootsie, he was really funny.
You know, he's really funny in Tootsie. He was, you know, part of it is that he was the old school guy who knew how to wrangle stars and knew how to bring everything together in a good Hollywood package of the kind that I think that probably most filmgoers over the age of 40, you know, wish they could have more of now. I mean, he was very, very good at classical Hollywood filmmaking. And, you know, that's something, you know, I say that as very, very high praise.
Well, we're very sorry about his passing, and we'll feature an interview with him coming up very soon on Fresh Air in a couple of minutes. John, always really good to talk with you. Thank you so much for sharing your impressions of the Cannes Film Festival.
No, I'm happy to do it.
John Powers is Fresh Air's critic at large and film critic for Vogue. Sidney Pollack's death took me by surprise. I'd just seen his name listed Sunday night in the credits of the HBO film Recount as an executive producer. Pollack has a role in the current film, Maid of Honor. He had a prominent role in last year's Oscar-winning Michael Clayton. Pollack died of cancer yesterday at the age of 73. He was diagnosed 9 months ago. He started his career as an actor in the late 1950s, then made his name as a director. He directed Sidney Poitier and Anne Bancroft in The Slender Thread, Jane Fonda in They Shoot Horses, Don't They?, Robert Redford and Barbara Streisand in The Way We Were, Paul Newman in Absence of Malice, Dustin Hoffman and Bill Murray in Tootsie, Robert Redford and Meryl Streep in Out of Africa, and Tom Cruise in The Firm. We're going to listen back to the interview I recorded with Pollack, but first let's hear a scene from Michael Clayton. Pollack plays Marty Bach, the head of a law firm which is handling a case that's falling apart because the head litigator, Arthur Edens, is having a nervous breakdown and expressing doubts about the case. Unless the situation is brought under control, this threatens the very future of the firm. Bach is talking to Michael Clayton, the law firm's fixer, played by George Clooney.
I don't know how you're going to take care of this, but this is cancer. This is something we don't get it reined in and cleaned up soon. Everything's vulnerable. Everything.
What are you telling me?
That I'm counting on you. I'm telling you that by this time next week, Arthur will be under control and everybody who needs to will have been reminded of your infinite value.
Jesus, Marty.
Hey, when did you get so f***ing delicate? I'm late.
I spoke with Sidney Pollack in 1990.
A lot of our listeners will know the way you look from your role in Tootsie. You not only directed the movie, but you played the role of Dustin Hoffman's agent. And I want to play a clip from a scene here in which Dustin Hoffman kind of storms into your office. And he, of course, plays this kind of difficult, self-absorbed actor. This is a scene before he takes the part of a woman's role in a soap opera. And he's in your office demanding to know why you can't get him a decent part, why he's always out of work.
You got one of the worst reputations in this town, Michael. Nobody will hire you.
Are you saying that nobody in New York will work with me?
Oh, no, that's too limited. Nobody in Hollywood wants to work with you either. I can't even send you up for a commercial. You played a tomato for 30 seconds. They want to half a day over schedule because you wouldn't sit down.
Yes, it wasn't logical.
You were a tomato! A tomato doesn't have logic! A tomato can't move!
That's what I said! So if he can't move, how's he gonna sit down, George? I was a stand-up tomato, a juicy, sexy beefsteak tomato! Nobody does vegetables like me! I did an evening of vegetables off Broadway! I did the best tomato, the best cucumber! I did an endive salad that knocked the critics on their ass!
One of the funny things about that scene is that it almost seems to be a joke about how obsessive Dustin Hoffman is as an actor, and I've always wondered if that scene reflects at all what the real working relationship was like.
Well, there was an awful lot written about the amount of arguing that Dustin and I were doing publicly. A lot of it true and a lot of it exaggerated. There's an element that Dustin is famous for of his, you know, of his fastidiousness that can sometimes drive people crazy. But and it's true that we argued and fought, not oddly enough about the acting. We fought mostly about script. We had slightly differing points of view about the tone of that, about what the tone of that picture ought to be, and so we argued. But usually we got our arguments over with fairly early in the morning, and by the time we got out on the set and started really working as director and actor within the context of a scene, we rarely argued after that.
It seems to me you were probably the kind of director who'd be more understanding of a very obsessive actor, having taught actors and having been the, you know, executive director of the West Coast branch of the Actors Studio. I mean, these you've worked with a lot of, you know, method actors.
Well, I started out as a teacher, actually. So the only thing I had as a tool when I began to direct was some understanding of the psychology of actors, let's say, or a language, a vocabulary to talk with them. I had no sense of how to talk to a writer, and I didn't know which end of a camera to look through because my background had all been theater. But I was comfortable with actors and always have been, really.
How come you haven't acted more? I mean, at what point you started off acting? At what point in your career did you think that, although you loved theater, that acting wasn't for you?
Somebody recommended to me, actually a director named John Frankenheimer and then Burt Lancaster, the actor. I'd worked together with them on a movie as a coach. I was a dialogue coach for a couple of young actors on a movie in 1960 called The Young Savages. And they both encouraged me very strongly to direct, and that was a new idea to me. It was not something I never had any strong goals to be a director. And they pushed very hard, and so I thought, well, what the hell, I'll try it. And so I moved to California, and I started doing it. Once I began to do that, I had no thoughts about acting at all. Dustin really pushed me into doing that. I never would have played that part. That was another source of irritation, is he started insisting that I play this part. Dustin believes that there's enough to make up on a set, that any time you can get close to the truth, you should do it. And what he kept saying was, I don't know why I put the dress on. In Some Like It Hot, the guys put the dress on because of machine guns. They're gonna die if they don't disguise themselves. We got to really get me a reason. And I kept saying, well, when your agent says to you, you're never going to work again, and he says, well, I would put it on if you said it to me, but I wouldn't put it on if a peer said it to me, because I had a very good actor all set to play that part. And he kept saying, I want you to play that part. And I kept saying, Dustin, you're crazy. I got enough to do. I haven't acted in years, and I don't want to do it. And finally he started sending me flowers, dozens of roses, saying, please be my agent. Love, Dorothy. You know. And I really ended up doing it basically to mollify him.
Well, you know, the him wanting to know, like, why is he putting on a dress reminds me of him in the scene wanting to know, you know, like, how can a tomato sit down?
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Were there other explanations you had to give him in the movie?
Not so much explanations, but...
Motivations.
But yeah, motivations. Well, no, it's very hard to do what an actor does, and it's very subjectively driven. And it's very, very hard for a very good actor, and Dustin is a very good actor. It's very, very hard for them sometimes to see in third person, which is really the director's job, of how this is going to work. Because to do the part well, you begin to see the world from inside of the role. And sometimes you can get confused or you misunderstand intentions, which are coming from the outside in, which is, you know, the director trying to have some sort of overview of it. So occasionally, sure, there are always, I wouldn't say fights, but discussions about how can I do this or how can I do that when this happened? And then you have to carefully explain it, not so much with intellectual logic, but with some sort of behavioral logic.
You were explaining that your transition into directing was working as a dialogue coach for a movie Frankenheimer directed, The Young Savages.
Mm-hmm.
And that starred Burt Lancaster and Shelley Winters.
Mm-hmm.
What did you do as dialogue coach? And did you work directly with Lancaster and Winters?
No, what I did, well, my job originally was to, there were three young men in that picture who were very inexperienced. They were kind of novice, new actors. They were playing juvenile delinquents. And my job basically was to kind of coach them in their acting and work with them on the roles. I had done that once before in a television show called The Turn of the Screw, a Playhouse 90 that John Frankenheimer had directed. And he had used me in that capacity. And I was able to do it without getting in his way. It's a tough job to do, to try to kind of direct actors and not get in the way of the director. But in this case, my job was to help these novice actors act, and Lancaster got curious as to what I was doing, and he used to say, "Hey kid, come over here. What are you telling those kids?" You know, and he started kidding around with me, and I finally began to talk to him about what I was talking to them about, and then he would occasionally talk to me about a scene himself, and we started to talk it over, and when the picture was all done, and I was supposed to come back to New York, I got a message from his secretary. He had a big office at Columbia. Said, "Mr. Lancaster wants to talk to you." And I went over there, and he sat behind his desk, and he said, "You know, you ought to be a director. You really should. What do you want to be told what to do when you can be telling everybody what to do for?" That was the way he put it. And he picked up the phone, and he called Lou Wasserman and said, "Lou, I got a kid here. I don't know if he can direct, but I think he's talented. I want you to talk to him." And I'm quoting verbatim now, and he said, "In any case, it can't be worse than those bums you got working for you now." And he said, so I had to go see Lou Wasserman feeling like an absolute dope, because Lou was clearly doing Bert a favor. He couldn't have cared less about me, and I must say he was a wonderful man. I went to see him in the office there, and he said, "Bert says you should be a director." And I said, "Well, I guess." He says, "Well, have you ever directed anything?" I said, "Nope." And, you know, I just sort of sat there like a dope. And he said, "Look, here's what I'll do. You come to California, and I'll let you come and observe for 6 months out at Universal Studios. I'll put you under the wing of a producer. And we'll go a step at a time. If they think you're talented, we'll see if we can get you a television show to do." And that's, in fact, what I did.
There's something very New York about you. I mean, in Tootsie, you're the New York agent. You said that you know, people that Burt Lancaster thought of you as the New York acting coach. You're from Indiana. How did you get to be so New York?
I guess that was the age that I was when I got here. You know, it was I was 17. I'd just gotten out of high school. And I spent those years, those 6 years, 7 years, between the time I was 17 and 24, and I guess they're sort of formative years. And I took to New York like a guy who'd, you know, been missing it all his life. I don't know. I just felt at home here from the first day I got off a train and settled in at a YMCA and sort of, you know, went to school and began making friends. It still feels like home in many ways to me.
Do you have any cameos in movies from your acting days that we could look for you in?
I mean
small parts. I shouldn't say cameos. You weren't a star doing a little star turn there.
I'm in a lot of my movies, but not in anything recognizable. I'm in 3 Days of the Condor and I'm in Electric Horseman.
Uh-huh.
But usually that'll happen because sometimes the hardest thing to do is if you have one line. You have a character, let's say, that's got one line and it's with one of the stars and it's during movement, let's say the scene is a dollying shot or a tracking shot or something that's difficult technically, and you need somebody to hit a mark and say one line. Well, it's really gets tough sometimes because the actors that are playing parts that small, it's really unfair to them to rush them in and have them do it quickly. They're nervous. They're much more nervous than somebody who's got a bigger role to play and can get accustomed to the star. They're nervous in front of the star. They're nervous in front of the director. And sometimes you just lose an enormous amount of time. And rather than go through it all, I stick a mustache on sometimes and throw a, you know, and comb my hair funny and just jump in and do it. Not because I like acting, but just in the interest of efficiency.
Most of your movies, including your new movie Havana, were shot in Panavision. What is Panavision exactly?
Well, Panavision is a brand name. We think of it as synonymous with widescreen. Actually, mm-hmm. It isn't. Widescreen, the real name is scope. It's a ratio of the height of the screen to the width of the screen, and the Panavision or scope ratio is very wide. It's 2.33:1. The length from left to right is 2 1/3 times as long as the height is high. In other words, it'd be 2.33 inches wide to 1 inch high in that ratio. And it has a very different feeling than the standard film ratio, which is 1.85:1, which is what Havana is shot in. I love the widescreen, not for any other reason than you can get more information per second on the screen. When I did a film like They Shoot Horses, Don't They, which was all interiors, everybody argued with me about why in God's name I would want a widescreen process inside on a dance floor. And the answer was because I could see all of the other couples and still be in close-up on Jane Fonda and Michael Sarrazin, or that I would always have a sense of the background or a sense of environment. So I always loved this widescreen process. The problem is as more and more revenue began to come in from ancillary markets like television and cassettes,
mm-hmm.
It's a horrifying experience to see a scope picture on television. You see two noses, one on each side of the screen, talking to each other. It's a terrible experience. So the last two films, Out of Africa and Havana, I've shot in the standard ratio.
What were the movies that you really loved growing up that made you want to act?
The movies that I remember very vividly as a young man were movies like A Place in the Sun and Shane, and The Best Years of Our Lives. All the Kazan movies, I think, were the ones that made me think a lot about acting. Mm-hmm. By the time I was watching Kazan's movies, I was occasionally in some small plays in school, and watching Viva Zapata and On the Waterfront and East of Eden and you know, films like that. I was very aware for the first time of that was the first time I was really aware of a director, I think.
Yeah.
I always identified him with these great performances.
I was reading about you in Current Biography, and it described you as being known as a lion tamer because of your success with temperamental big-name stars, you know, because you've worked with Streisand and Streep, Redford, Hoffman, Newman. Do you think you have to be a lion tamer to work with temperamental big-name stars? I mean, do you think of yourself as having to deal with temperament a lot?
Not at all. Really not at all. I mean, I don't find them to be any more temperamental or any more difficult. I don't know why you would refer to them as a lion tamer, but I suppose the conventional picture of a star is someone who's got a big ego and bosses people around and therefore is difficult to work with. That's really not true. To be honest with you, I've found more temperament among the people that aren't the stars than I've found with the stars that I've worked with.
Actor, director, and producer Sidney Pollack, recorded in 1990. He died of cancer yesterday at the age of 73. Sadly, we have another death to note. The organ player Jimmy McGriff died Saturday at the age of 72.